Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, and I'm owner of the company Horns of Odin. Before we jump into today's show, I have to do a little bit of housekeeping because we do have to try and keep the lights on here. And the best way to do that is via our Patreon. So if you can take a second just to go over to patreon.com/Nordic Mythology Podcast, it's just £3 a month to join. You get to watch the episodes live. You get ad-free episodes. You get early access to all the episodes we do. You can, like I say, you can watch and join to the live chat, which is always a lot of fun. We have a nice group of people who come and watch live, and there's always like a side episode to the episode of people just talking, having a laugh, and yeah, a real good group of people in there. Which also you get access to the Discord server, which again is an extension of that chat where people just, it's like-minded people who get to hang out. Like I say, it's a lot of fun. It's a lovely little community, and for the tier up from that, you get the Storytime episodes with Jonas Lorentzen, which are a lot of fun. They're a lot of people's favorite episodes. We sit down, have a drink. Usually we read through one of the sagas, we get distracted. They're just a fun episode where we can just be a little bit silly. So yeah, if you can, like I said, it is difficult to make this, you know, we're 160 something episodes in. There is a whole team behind it. I just sit here and talk. We have you know, an editor, a booker, a social media person. There's a whole bunch of people who have to pay. So please give us some money. if you can, obviously, not everyone can. If you can, then just support the podcast by giving us a 5-star review and a 5-star rating and a positive review. How does that sound? All right. Let's jump into the show.
Graceful landing.
Yeah, you know, you got to dig yourself out there somehow. And that voice is today's guest, and it is Jameson Foster. So Jameson, do you want to tell people who you are and say that incredibly difficult word that I want to avoid saying?
Yeah, hello, everyone. Some of you in here already know me, but I am Jameson Foster. I am an ethnomusicologist here at University of Colorado Boulder. Ethnomusicology is just a big fancy word to say that I study people music, because if you break down the word ethnomusicology, it just means that I study the music of people. So it's not a really useful title either. But I also have one foot in Nordic studies here at CU Boulder with Matthias Nordvig, who some around here might be very familiar with. Mm-hmm. And it was through him that I met you last year at Midgardsblot. And I got to say, man, it was pretty lonely this year without you.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. I missed it. I did miss it. But unfortunately, Mr. Rocco didn't have anyone to watch him, and he's not old enough to stay home alone on his own yet. So
aww.
I had to, I was disappointed because I was meant to be there. But unfortunately, the gentleman who usually looks after him, he sadly passed away quite suddenly. It was a very sort of tragic series of, it's a tragic series of events, but very kind of quick things where he was booked in to be looked after. And then like a couple of weeks before, the gentleman passed away. So I was stuck in the middle of the school holidays. But then again, it's one of those situations where it's like, I can't complain. I can't be like,
yeah, I would say that's a valid reason. Far as excuses go, that's pretty valid, right?
Exactly. It's like, I can't go online and leave a bad fucking Trustpilot and be like, can't look after my dog. I can't go to Norway now. It's like, so it kind of like levels things out as well. You know, the gentleman was only 41. It's very humbling in its own instance. He's like, you know what? It's shit. I would love to be there, but what can you do?
Yeah, right.
But yeah, I missed it. How was it?
Oh, dude, it was a great time. I put up a video. Look at that. 2 minutes in, I already derailed myself. The reason that I'm here is because I do Nordic music. There we go. I run the Nordic Sound Channel. Me and my co-host here on my shoulder, Cricket. He's asleep right now, but when he wakes up, I can guarantee you he'll be a little element of chaos. So for now, I'm going to enjoy him behaving.
Cricket is a parakeet, by the way, not just like a,
it is a parakeet.
Small gentleman,
okay.
Who's just sat on your shoulder asleep. Like, just,
yes, for listeners, there's not just a small man on my shoulder.
Could be Jiminy Cricket, you know, just have a little actual cricket in a top hat just hanging out there.
Yeah, thank you for the save, Daniel. Yeah, for the listeners, I have a parakeet on my shoulder, and together we run the Nordic Sound Channel. And this year we were, well, not Cricket, he wasn't allowed to go, but I went over to Midgardsblot to cover it, talk to some musicians there, talk to some instrument makers there. So I'm always over at Midgard's Blot because that's kind of like the heart of what I research. But just in general, Nordic music of all kinds, it's what I'm into.
And let's not skim over your own little project, because
Okay.
I find it fascinating, and
All right,
I
thank you,
love it.
Daniel.
No, I do. I love banjos. I genuinely, I
Oh,
just.
you're talking about,
Oh
are you
yeah.
talking about Scuzzlebutt?
Oh yeah.
All
We're not getting away from that.
right. Okay, well, I didn't know how relevant that was. Yeah, so I'm a banjo player. I have a little project called Scuzzlebutt. For any of you who've been watching South Park since the beginning of time, it was the name of like a mountain cryptid that lived in Colorado, and I live in Colorado, and so I just took the name for my weird pagan banjo project. So thank you, Dan, for reminding me about that.
It sounds insane. I'm not gonna lie, Jameson. It does sound quite insane, like a Nordic banjo hybrid, but it's also great. I just there's
Thanks,
something
man.
about banjos. Like, I don't know what it is. There's just that sound to it that kind of.
They're like pretty primitive, right? Like a banjo is a very, it's just the way that we play it now is just an evolution of a very old instrument of just stringing banjo string or stringing strings across a gourd, right? But the Nordic banjo thing was this weird idea I actually had coming back from my first Midgard's Blot last year, where I was just after spending a week just marinating in that pagan Nordic music, I came home to play the banjo. I was like, I bet I could come up with something Nordic on this. And I really knew I had something when I showed it to Matthias, expecting him to hate it, and he was smiling ear to ear. And that's when I was
Yeah,
like, I think I'm onto something. This made Matthias smile.
that's not an easy thing to do.
It is if you play banjo, apparently.
Well, yeah. No, it is a it the banjo is an odd one for me, as in a sense, like we don't. It's not really associated with England. Like I think maybe you're gonna tell me it is in
No,
some way.
Ireland brought it back, and it became adapted in like Irish music, but England is probably not outside of England does have like a strangely strong bluegrass scene, but that's about it.
See, for me, I would just, and I would assume most people would think the same, or I'm just an anomaly and talking out my ass. But I always thought of the banjo as just being like an American thing, or like a South American thing in particular. That was like my, I don't know, maybe that's just been hindered by TV.
No, man, I mean, like, we can make this about banjo if you want, but like, yeah, the banjo was brought over to essentially like the Gulf regions from the slave trade, and then it sort of like dispersed outwards from there. And yeah, it is mostly associated with like the deep south in the United States, but like it'd probably be more accurate to say like Appalachia in general, which is the eastern mountain range. You've got the Rockies on the west, you've got Appalachia on the east. And yeah, so the banjo just became very deeply rooted in American culture. And I'm a huge bluegrass player myself, so I just picked it up and has a lot of fun.
Well, just mix the two worlds together, which is
Yep. That's what I like to do. I just like to take weird things that people say don't belong together and put them together and see what happens.
okay. Tell it to,
Okay.
but tell me about the mask, because the mask is fucking brilliant.
I've actually got the mask up here somewhere on the shelf, but Alyssa, my wife, made it. Because a big part of the thing that struck me about Midgard's Blot and then also like this pagan music stuff in general is just the prevalence of masks. And from my work that I do as an ethnomusicologist and the friends that I've made from all over the world who study musics from all over the world, masks have always been a huge part of like spiritual music because it creates, there are a lot of different reasons, but the most uniform reason is that when you don a mask, you assume a different personality, a different persona that is detached from who you are, because no matter how spiritual a ritual is, you're still just a person. And so that mask will typically be a way to create a divide between how people know you and your role as some sort of spiritual leader. Not that I'm a spiritual leader. The reason I put on the mask was really just to create that wall that is between what people know of you and the mask itself. Because something I've always had to deal with is I've got a bit of a goofy face. I'll admit, like, people laugh when they see me. It's a good thing. I think it's a good thing, right? But I just have like this way, this mannerism about me that just like puts people at ease or makes them chuckle or something. And that's just part of life that I've accepted. But there's a side effect of that is I have trouble playing serious music. because people see my face playing music and they're like, ah, that's just Jameson, right? And so I kind of put on the mask to be like, all right, let's try and create that sort of separation there. But then also it keeps me focused. If I'm wearing the mask, I can really only look down. And so if I look up while I'm playing for people, I don't really get distracted as easily. So a lot of different things, but Alyssa made it. She's an incredible artist. And I love the thing.
It's very cool. If you want to see the mask, just go Scuzzlebutt on Spotify.
Yeah, Scuzzlebutt on Spotify, or my handle on Instagram is Banjo Druid. It's ridiculous. It's just meant to be dumb fun, and I have a great time doing it. So,
but that's when the best things happen, when they're just good fun.
Yeah, I agree, man. Yeah, it's funny because I've had a lot of music projects in my time, and this is like the only one that's really like put roots down. And I think that's just because it's more for me than anyone, and it for some reason it resonates with other people too. So, I'm running with it. I'm having fun. It's a good time.
Do you think you find confidence behind the like a mask?
Yeah, definitely. As I said, right, like everyone has the way that people work, right, is they look at the face of someone they know and they've got all these ideas and memories behind them. And knowing that I can put on a mask and just assume a different persona, or at least put that wall between me and the people in the audience who might know me, it's just easier for everything, really. I've just found that performing with a mask on has just like completely changed the way that I perform music. And I've been playing music for half my life. So,
yeah, it is. Masks are such a fascinating thing, and I'm sure there's a whole episode with masks in general, because they do have this weird effect on people, whether it's for good or bad. You know, it can be used for good, it can give you confidence, but there are people who they'll put on a hockey mask and be in a like a riot situation, and then think they're like a different person and there are no consequences to their actions, and just would act possibly completely out of character, whether it's the anonymity. That's the one. you got me there. Thank you. The anonymity of it. So there are, you know, they can be used for good, but there is a lot of power just behind. What can this be as simple as just a little piece of plastic or anything?
Yeah,
like a bit of cloth.
But the idea goes back so far, and it's also pretty wide ranging, right? So the old, I cannot remember the name of the tribe, but there was a tribe in Greenland a few thousand years ago, and we find, not we, I'm not an archaeologist, but so archaeologists have found masks all over the place, and there's always a hierarcho, and there's always a spiritual link with them. But then also in Nigeria, you know, I've got a good friend here in my program from Nigeria, and she's actually studying masked performance as an ethnomusicologist. And back home where she's from, masks are also just a huge part of spiritual gatherings. So two very different places, Nigeria and Greenland, but they still have the same idea of put a mask on when you're doing music or you're doing some sort of spiritual gathering.
Okay, let's get into ethnomusicology.
All right, break
it down nice and slow into every syllable and I'll get it. I know you briefly said what it was at the start, but what is it?
Yes,
for someone like me, just what, who can hardly say the word, what is it?
Yeah, so ethnomusicology, I kind of poked fun at it, and ethnomusicologists do this, right, is that ethnomusicology at the beginning was actually more defined by what it wasn't than what it was. So before we even get into ethnomusicology, we have a field called musicology. And this starts in like the late 1800s as this study of, look at the word musicology. It's the study of music. And the reason that it came about was, to simplify it, people wanted to learn more about the lives of composers. So for instance, you know, you have the cult to Beethoven. People start studying Beethoven's life. They want to put his music in the context of his life. People like, or musicologists would have done things like write program notes, or if you open up a CD and you read like background information, that's musicology. Now, the problem with it is that musicologists only looked at classical music from Europe. So you have this field of study that's incredibly useful, right? Looking at music in the context of the people who are making it, rather, as opposed to something like music theory, which looks at the notes on the page, right? So musicology has this potential to like really help understanding of music in its social contexts. But musicologists at this time, right, the turn of the century, really refuse to think that any music outside of, European classical music is worth exploring, right? So ethnomusicology came up when people were like, what about folk music, right? And so ethnomusicology became a way to sort of study why music is the way it is around the world, too. There are a lot of problematic roots in ethnomusicology that ethnomusicologists are still wrestling with today, right? You take anything about studying other peoples at the turn of the century, and you can see why it's going to get a little weird. But over the decades, ethnomusicologists have sort of carved out a niche for themselves in studying pretty much the music of anyone in its social contexts. I have a classmate here. His name is Isaac. He studies the Gregorian chant of Native Americans, right? That is not something a musicologist would have done 100 years ago. Ubochi, my friend here from Nigeria, she's studying masked music performance. That's ethnomusicology because the strength of the term is the same thing I was just poking fun at. You're just studying the music of people. And the most important thing that I think ethnomusicology does is it doesn't look at music in a vacuum. It looks at music in the context of the people and the culture that makes it. And so essentially that's what I do with Nordic music, is I'm looking at more than just the notes on the page. I'm looking at more than just one genre. I'm just in general interested in the role that music plays in the general narrative and history of the Nordic countries, because it's pretty fascinating. Does that
Okay,
help?
it does. It does.
Okay. Yeah, so at its most simple, you can think of ethnomusicology studies folk music, but it has grown outward from there from the beginning.
So how do we, or how could we ever, or how do you apply that to particularly like anything from like the Vikings, when you get back to a certain time period where we don't have instruments, we don't have music, but we know they must have had music. And obviously now there is this huge resurgence or like boom in what people can try and recreate as like Viking age music. Even though I would say probably most of the big ones don't say that they're quite openly saying like it's more like folk music inspired
That's a
by.
problem we talk about, right? Is they're constantly saying this isn't Viking music, but everyone's calling it Viking music,
Exactly.
right? Yeah,
Exactly.
it's a
That
common problem.
exactly, but I think it's because there isn't really a better solution. But then you get some probably metal bands that are like, this is Viking music. And he's like, that's definitely fucking not Viking music. That one's not. I'm not naming any, I'm not gonna put any names out there, but
I know
some of
for a
them,
fact Vikings do not have Schecters, all right? Like,
yeah, I know some of them. Yeah, I'm not gonna actually no, I'm gonna pull back.
no, you're good, man.
So yeah, how can, or is it even possible to apply ethnomusicology to like a time period like that, or do you have to then look further in the future and try and work back?
Yeah, so this is one of the strengths of ethnomusicology too, is the fact that we often work with multiple different fields. Actually, in some, I'm lucky enough to hear at CU Boulder, a lot of universities will put a hard line between musicology and ethnomusicology. I've never believed in that line. I think that they're both the same thing. It's just it's a difference of approach. But that difference goes to the point where in some universities, like if my memory serves me correctly, Indiana, ethnomusicology isn't even in the music department. It's in the folklore studies department. But I think that's a strength of ethnomusicology is that we are so often put with other disciplines like archaeologists, like folklorists, historians, sociologists, anthropologists. And getting back to the Viking music thing, is an ethnomusicologist like myself can use the work done by archaeologists, etc., to try and piece together some idea of what the music from the Viking age might have sounded like. There are some basic assumptions that you can make about music in the Viking age, right? There are some intervals. If I had an instrument with me, I would play them, but maybe it wouldn't translate well over the microphone. But there are some intervals, and intervals are the basis of how we make chords or how we, string sounds together that just appear in nature. If you hit a bell, or if let's say you're blacksmithing and you hit a piece of metal, you are hearing a lot of different notes, and especially if you hit that hammer a different way every time, you're going to hear a different note, right? So there are, and these are notes that occur in nature. And so we can gather that they at least have these intervals that are naturally occurring in bird song, like Cricket here, if he starts getting fussy, or hitting a hammer, hitting a bell, right? So we have these basic assumptions we can make about some sounds, and we can fill in the gaps. We've been fortunate enough to find wind instruments from both England and Scandinavia. In an old Jorvik, which is now York, archaeological site, we found something that resembles a pan flute, right? And the intervals of it, the reason that wind instruments are so important is that they don't really detune over time the same way like a banjo would, right? If you bury a banjo in the dirt, right, even 5 years later, that is not going to be the same notes that it was buried with, even if it still has strings. But a wind instrument is going to keep roughly the same notes. And so we can play this from York from the Viking Age, and it has notes in it that pretty closely resemble the first five notes of a major scale that we have today. And that's because a lot of the intervals that you hear in a major scale or a minor, well, mostly a major scale, do occur naturally, and they're pretty easy to, tune out of a pan flute.
Okay, so did you just say the note? Okay. This things like this
I know, right?
that are just so obvious that you should just know, but you don't know unless somebody tells you them. Because it makes complete sense that notes would be based on natural sounds, but until someone says notes are based on natural sounds, it's just not something that you kind of put together.
Right, like in Europe you have the cuckoo, right? The cuckoo bird. That thing, it's the cuckoo, that's in a what we call a perfect fifth, and that's the basis for most chords that we play, and that's the most common interval you're going to hear in people who are recreating ancient music. That's the most common along with an octave. But getting it past just like those two intervals of a fifth and an octave, right? Like our music today didn't come from nowhere. It's a part of a long development, at least in European music, of how we use notes. And it goes back a lot farther than people think it does. Like Gregorian chant from 600s, 500s, they're using modes that we use today. It's just what we don't know is how, for instance, Vikings would have used those notes. And the closest that we get is just in a either old Gregorian chant written down. As a matter of fact, the earliest chant we have written down that is polyphonic, meaning that it has chords and harmonies in it, is from Orkney when Orkney was inhabited by Norwegians. So we can look at things like this from the 1200s, and that's pretty close to the Viking Age, and we see how they were thinking about and using music. We can fill in the gaps, but I think the strength in modern recreation of Viking music is more in how people use their imagination to fill in the gaps of what we don't know. That's, at least to me, what I really love about the music of Arjuna, for instance, is we have the instruments that they would have used roughly. We have some rough idea of how they would have used sound. That's about it. And it's where they fill in the gaps that this music is really interesting to me.
Yeah, I think that's I think yeah, that's this whole genre in general, not just musically, like just everything to do with Nordic mythology or the Viking Age, is because there's so many gaps that people can fill in and just apply to their own life. And I think that's what keeps this so fresh, I think, because this whole interest in Vikings, I think, certainly spiked around the TV show Vikings, like into the popular culture.
Yeah, at least internationally, yeah.
It really start to spike there. And you would think that it would start to have, I mean, maybe it is tapering off. I don't know, but I don't know, because it still seems like there is such an interest in it. Whereas, you had like things like Twilight that came out, and there was a huge vampire craze. But within like,
Don't send that back to me.
no, okay,
I left
but
that.
you do, there are these times where there is, or at least in my lifetime, I've seen like crazes with, like I say, with Twilight, and around that there was just vampire film after vampire film after like vampire
My
TV
God, you're
show,
right.
vampire everything. But then after like a few years, it just tapered off and became something else. Whereas I'm not saying Vikings and vampires are comparable, but it just seems as though the obsession with the Scandinavian culture, the Viking Age, doesn't seem to be shifting anywhere, particularly like in North America. There is like that huge interest is back looking, and maybe it is because the country's so young that they look back to the east and look for for, I guess, the heritage wise?
Yeah, I mean, like, so I did a video on this about a month and a half ago as to why Americans in particular can be interested in Vikings. I will never say that I have all the answers, right? But I can only speak from my point of view. But before I talk about that, I do want to say that, like, the interest in Vikings, the way that I put it is it doesn't go away, it just slumbers. Because especially if you look at the musical history of how musicians have used Viking imagery throughout history, right? Wagner, the biggest superstar of opera composition, arguably, his 8-hour long opera cycle was all about Norse mythology, right? The Ring, Der Ring, I'm not even going to butcher the German here on the spot, but the Ring of the Nibelungens, right? It's essentially the Volsunga saga. And he tried to say it was German, but a few people have gone back and come through. It's like, no, this is like 80% Nordic. So that's back in 1860, yeah, in Germany. So in the 1860s, if you want to think of operas as like the movies of the time period, Wagner's operas were like friggin' Marvel. And at the center of it was Norse mythology, the Volsunga saga. So then it slumbers for a bit, but then especially around between World War I and World War II, especially in Norway, people got into using Norse mythology for music again. And now it's come back up in black metal in the late 20th century and all this. And now we have things like Vardruna. So I think the interest in Viking stuff never goes away entirely. It just sleeps for a little bit before someone remembers it. But at least why Americans and at least Americans like me, okay, because I can only speak from my own point of view. Heritage is definitely a huge part of it. People in the United States, especially if they grew up in the suburban United States, they want their culture to be more than Walmart and McDonald's, right? But you can't, it's really hard to get away from that if you're brought up in a family that doesn't actually practice or acknowledge heritage. I was fortunate enough that I did. But I'm not Nordic at all. Okay. Like my family is very German, Irish, Scottish. But there's just something about understanding history or the history of your family or where you come from a time before modern things happen. It's really just this recurring theme of just like being reluctant to embrace modernity or maybe just being outright hostile towards modern life that causes some people to look to some sort of heritage that goes back to before things were what someone might call modern. And where a lot of people land is Vikings just because they left the most evidence of how people acted, what people thought, what people wrote about. They leave the most evidence of that of anyone from Europe. And again, I'm
Cool as
also only talking
shit
about
are
like
they as
Euro
well.
descended.
They're
What?
cool as sh they're just cool as shit.
And they're just cool, right? Like I have a friend
Yeah.
who was giving a presentation on Heilung at a conference, and someone was asking, like, well, why are people doing this? And he was like, well, it's fun. That's all there is to it
It's cool,
sometimes,
isn't
right?
it?
It's a good time. And I think that on top of it just gives people an escape from aspects of modern life that they're maybe not too thrilled about. At least that's where I come from. And that's what really gets me about, studying ancient Nordic music or even not even ancient. Where I started with all this was Nordic folk music, like fiddling and dance music. There's just something about it that just like gives me that escapism that so many people like me crave for.
I think people have always done it because, I mean, it's tough without being all nihilistic. It is tough to look at the world on social media and not be like, oh, we're just fucked. Like, there's whether it's the news or whether it's people gluing themselves to the fucking pavement because of climate change or Trump being impeached or somebody getting shot by the police or something. It just feels like the whole world is a pressure cooker,
That's a good way to put it.
particularly when it comes to like race issues as well. It feels like there's this heightened emphasis on race at the minute. Like everything wants to be put in, whether it's an article to try and make things sell more, get people to read the article. They want to just put these trigger words in there. It just feels like everything's just ramping up. So it's hard not to be like, oh, not to see like past the immediate future, especially with price rises. I don't know if it's the same in the USA at the minute, but in
Dude, 2 months ago, eggs in the US were like $8 for a dozen. So like, yeah, I get it.
So like in the UK as well, like prices just keep going up and up, and it's like, you know, where is it gonna stop? There has to be a point, but when you can't see it, so it's easy to see why people would then look backwards at like another time. But I wonder if people have always done that, or is it just now because we have access to more information?
No, I can't really speak for anything past, because I'm not really that well read in this would fall under sociology or something like that. I'm not well read in this from before, like maybe the 1800s. But what I do know is that at least from the 18th century onwards, there has been a human habit, at least in the West, to whenever things get tumultuous, whenever things get uncertain, they sort of take comfort by escaping into something more pastoral or something from the past. Because when things are changing a lot, it offers people comfort to like go back to, you know, Pepperidge Farm remembers. And so that's sort of what people want to go back to sometimes, because it is comforting, right? Because the benefit with looking back to the past is we can remember it the way we want to remember it. Whereas the present, we can't really choose the way that the present is, because there are a lot of people also watching it at the same time going, no, that's not really how it's going on right now. And I think that's a huge part of the conflict that you're also bringing up is, you know, especially in a place like the States, this place is huge. People underestimate how massive the United States is all the time. Go drive through Wyoming and still tell me if you think that the United States is not that big, right? But the problem is you have these people growing up in completely different parts of the world, completely different states, other sides of the country, and in this case, the continent, and which is essentially another part of the world. If you compare like New Mexico to Maine, right? Two completely different places, but they're both the United States. But those two cultures have to agree on the same president, for instance. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's a big problem that's pretty unique to the United States, I think, just because of our size and the way that democracy works over here.
Yeah, I think they you do get a when you
and Canada sit, too, Jen. Yeah.
when you sit at the top, like. You know, America, for whatever bad you want to say about it, has been the pinnacle for a long time of what people have looked towards. There's a reason why, you know, all the movies are made there, the TV shows, everything looks towards there, and the rest of the world tends to copy. Whether you like it or not, that's just how it's been. It's been the pinnacle. So then everybody criticizes and hits up. Because it's easy to do, because you're looking up at that thing, so you're criticizing and you're hitting up, and we live in a time with social media where everything bad is instantly put online, but you only see the bad part. No one's posting all the good things that people do every day. It's just the bad stuff that it gets put on there, and everyone just thinks America is just this giant cesspit, when in reality, it's, you know, you should look at it as like a collection of a bunch of different countries. Oh, that's how I think it would be more aptly put, is like just a collection of a ton of different countries under one overall government, almost like Europe is, in a sense of, in before we left, before we fucked it up, but like it was still is for
before
some.
Before we left,
probably was for some. But that idea of like, but you probably do get that same culture shift as far as from like Spain to I was going to say Norway, but they're not really in Europe. So Sweden. So from like Spain to Sweden, that you probably get that culture shift similar in the USA, like that huge difference.
Very much so, but you can say different country, right? In the United States, there's just something mentally about saying different country, right? Because it's not a different country, even though spatially it might as well be. But yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there, where this is just what I noticed is people who spend most of their time on the internet, notably Reddit, like just judging will like draw a conclusion about what life is like in the United States just from the front page of Reddit. And it's just like always this, it's just so inaccurate, because I'm very much one of those people who are like, I'll shit talk America because I'm American, right? But if someone else shit talks America, I'm like, hey man, all right, I'm from there, right? It's my home, right?
So you can pick on your little brother, but if someone else picks on your little fucking...
Exactly, right? That's what it is. So That's how I feel because, you know, the image that is created here is definitely from an outside looking in. It seems a lot worse. Like people think that I'm not going to be able to come back alive from just walking to the grocery store. But, you know, people like in day-to-day life are very friendly, very happy. But it is there is that happy is relative. So I'll just say friendly. But there is something to be said about perception, right? So even if you are American and let's say you're an American who spends all day on Reddit. You think that it's a horrible place to live and that no one likes each other and all that. So you do look for other types of escapism. Yeah. So I do think that the perception of what living here is like is just as important as the reality because humans, we're inherently irrational and feelings will generally guide, you
Yeah.
know, how we think more
Well,
than even measurable objective facts, right?
I
That's one
catch
of our weaknesses and our strengths. Yeah.
my honestly, like, this is how psychotic I can be sometimes. I was watching a film the other day, and I was this sounds fucking crazy when I say this out loud, right? I was watching a movie and I was really enjoying it, and then I was like, I got broke off for something and I had to like pause it. I was on my phone. I was like, oh, I'll just like check the rating of the movie. First of all, don't fucking do that because obviously, because this is what happens. So I checked the movie, the rating of the movie, and like a terrible rating, like 22% on Rotten Tomatoes, like 4 on IMDb or something. And then instantly, I was like, oh, this is a shit movie. Even though I was sat fucking enjoying the film, I was enjoying it. I liked the movie. But as soon as I saw the perception of like other people's opinions and read like there some of the reviews that said, oh, this is bad, don't like this. And then suddenly I'm like, oh, this is a bad movie. And then I was kind of
Dan, that
grumpy
is
for
so
the rest of
relatable.
it. I was grumpy for the rest of it. It's like, why has that happened? Why have I let myself do that? Because I was literally enjoying the film. It was a good film. I was like, this is really good. Texting my friends, like, fucking hell, this is a good film.
Yeah, man. I mean, like, so if I could tie a bow on like this part of the conversation, right? It's
Yeah,
just
we've gone
like,
way off topic, so.
no, I know, but like, just like you said, right? Is I'll be sitting here and be like, oh, you know, I hate living in 2023. It's just, things are so messed up, and you know, I hate the way things are. And then I'll like go fishing in the Rocky Mountains, and I'm like, it's a pretty good time to be alive. So that's just the duality of man, you know?
Yeah.
We're allowed to be horribly contradictory.
We are, yeah, but we're just fed such negativity, I think. I think that I genuinely think that's the issue. I think if news outlets and social media just pushed more positive content,
Good
then,
luck, dude.
well, that's it because they know that terrible things sell. Like
Yeah, I just.
the stuff you can get away with on YouTube and Facebook is wild compared to what it used to be. Like you can, I was
Oh
watching,
man, the dark days.
like yeah, it's. They, I'm sure they used to censor everything. Like the other day, like I'm into like MMA fighting, that kind of stuff. And I found a channel and it's just like clearly very illegal fights that are not sanctioned. There's no rules. You can eye gouge, you can bite.
Oh, dark web, dude, that's not
No,
YouTube.
this is on YouTube. And like it's not that kind of fighting is not for me. I'm not interested in watching that. But like I stumbled upon it, I'm like, how is this on YouTube? Like, I don't understand how that's passing the boundaries where people can just, yeah, it's just odd to me. But whereas I feel like 5 years ago that would have been censored, like it would have been picked up on.
Yeah, I don't know, man. The internet's just the Wild West at this point. And I'm speaking as someone who's living in the Wild West. It's just like, you know, no rules at all. But you know, if I could actually bring this back to music, right?
Back to music. Yeah, I was gonna
Is,
say,
you
let's
know,
get back
if
to
you
music.
no, no, Dan, I love talking to you. You know that. That's why I knew this was gonna be dangerous. is like, so you talk about how, you know, a big part of the problem is, you know, out different outlets, different medias pushing these things that are, you know, forcing us into different baskets or maybe altering our perception of reality in a really not so great way. And I think that a lot of people do end up taking it upon themselves to sort of create their own reality. And there are merits to that, and there are very clear downsides to it. But where this relates to music is that a lot of people do choose to create their own reality through the music that they listen to. You can see us all the time in Midgar's Blood, or even if you just want to go to a Heilung show, right? That is escapism as it, at its finest. If people want to get together, and this is one of the beautiful things about live music making to me, and this is something that I'm writing about and that I study, is that when you get together with people to create music, you are collectively imagining things together. And I think a Heilung show is a really beautiful example of this. Is even though it's 2023, most of the people in that audience probably work tech jobs, especially if I'm going to a show in Denver, right? The people there are leaving that behind for just how long is a Heilung show? An hour and a half? Just leaving that behind to collectively imagine together, maybe to a hallucinatory degree, a different way that things could be. And this to me is something that I've just found from talking to people and reading up on how people think about bands like Heilung or Vardruna. Is it is escapism, but I think it's escapism in a really productive way where when people listen to this music together in a live setting, people are sort of getting together with like-minded people, usually like-minded enough, let's say, to together just pretend that things are different. And the reason that this is important is because that disruption from your everyday life to get a different perspective on what life could be, a perspective gained from going to Midgar's Blot. Or perspective gained from, let's even really throw a curveball here, going to a bluegrass festival. The perspective that you gain from just detaching from life, looking at it from a different point of view, and spending it with people who also enjoy the same music you do, that means likely that they envision a very similar world that you do, at least in the realm of Heilung or bluegrass. That's where people start to take it upon themselves to, maybe if I can put this in like a really cynical way, to get together and deceive themselves about what reality is, but I think in a really healthy way, because I do it, right? Like I get super into Heilung shows when I go, I get super into Midgar's Blot when I go, but there's just something that I think is really restorative and really regenerative about listening to music with people in a live setting and sort of looking around and being like, this is the way the world could be. And that to me is one of the more beautiful things about music, and it's why I get up every day and read and write about it.
Oh, wonderful. So do you think culturally the way we li obviously the way we listen to music is different, but I guess the in I guess what music is in general, how we adapt into our lives, do you think that's very different now compared to, let's say, in the Viking Age? Do you think, like,
Oh,
what
yeah,
music
man.
is, what it's used for, what the yeah. Does that make
Yeah,
sense?
so, you know, it does. Sorry, I was waiting to make sure I wasn't going to cut you
Yeah,
off.
no.
Because with Zoom, it's hard to know if you're interrupting someone or not. But yeah, so music and transcendence. Music has been used throughout the world and throughout history with anything spiritual. If you look around at the world, at the religions of the world, spiritualities of the world, almost all of them have music as a foundational role in some part of ritual or worship or gathering. This is because music transcends speech. When we talk right now, we are in the real world. If we were to be singing this conversation, like in an opera, suddenly it takes
Everyone
on
would
an.
turn off. Everyone would be like, off.
Suddenly, it takes on an otherworldly nature. And this is sort of why music has been so foundational to a lot of rituals, regardless of the spirituality or religion, because something about singing in particular takes you somewhere else, and it's a way of communicating beyond worldly matters. This is why chant, I was mentioning chant earlier from like the 500s back. That's at the crux of a church service, for instance. That's because singing words has a much more profound influence on you than if those same words were just said to you, right? If I were to say out the words to a Bob Dylan song, and this is on basing this on the assumption that you would care about a Bob Dylan song, right? If I were to just read you a verse from Blowin' in the Wind, he'd be like, okay, whatever. Suddenly he sings Blowin' in the Wind, and suddenly you're like, yeah, man, fuck Vietnam. Right? Like that is the difference that music makes with this sort of thing. But if you were to look at how differently we consume music nowadays, that word consume I'm using very deliberately. Where nowadays, and this was kind of at the crux of ethnomusicology in the early days, was reminding people that like music is something that you do. Music is something that you do together, especially. In the ever since the phonograph, vinyl, CDs, streaming. Music has become a thing that you collect, that you own, that you trade, right? Music before the 1920s. So just think about the collective human experience before the 1920s. That's a really long time. So for a majority of human history, music has been something that you make together or that you experience together. And so music has this very important communal use, if I want to put it in just like a really objective way, of communal bonding, spirituality. If you get together and make music together, right, you're bonding on a way that you can't just if you just go grab a drink together. Music just, it, and this is something that musicologists and ethnomusicologists and anthropologists and sociologists have not been able to answer, is the why music does this. But music definitely affects us in a way that just speaking doesn't, or that other art forms even struggle to do. Music has always had a way to just like move us at a very deep level that's really hard to explain. And to me, as someone who just gets tired of being told all the time, oh, we know how this works, you know how this works, you're not allowed to be enchanted with this, you're not allowed to use your imagination with this because everything's measurable and all this. Music isn't. People try, but music will always be that little escapism that you get from objectivity and rationality. Because it nothing is about the way that music moves us makes any sense.
Yeah, it is so powerful. Like, there, I'm a very emotional person, and particularly when it comes to like music, movies, and I'll catch myself crying in films a lot. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time, it won't be the writing, the acting. It will be the little piece of music that fucking Hans Zimmer has wrote, and it's just got me in tears because
damn you, Hans Zimmer.
Yeah, like. But it is, there's just something about it. As soon as the music comes in, it probably is everything together, but it can just pull emotions out of you. Everybody listening to this probably has a connection to that, to one song that you can put it on, and it's just going to put you in a different kind of state, a very emotional place. Mm-hmm. We all have it, and it is such a powerful thing.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I'm on board with you, man. I'm very emotional. People learn when they go to Midgar's Blow with me that I'm crying like every other set, man. Like, this year especially ruined me, right? We had Katalina Baruch and we had Mari Boina and Steve Von Till, who just like, the way that Alyssa says to me, she won't let me put on Steve Von Till's music around her because she says she hasn't had enough therapy, right? So, but me, I voluntarily listen to that stuff because I enjoy the way the music moves me. And very early on, people learn that it's not remarkable when I say that a piece of music made me cry. It's like, yeah, but you do that all the time. Yeah. I'm very open about it. Like, it's just something about, I would think that it would go without saying that music is very important to me.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
But what's important to me about it isn't how it works or so much like the why it works, but just like sort of seeing the way that it sort of subverts all modern expectations of like that we understand everything. And especially Midgar's Blood. I don't know if you ever had the chance to go down to the drum circle last year, but the reason that Midgar's Blood is so special to me is that in action, you see the power of something as simple as a drum circle. And I know that it's really funny that the Colorado guy is sitting around right now preaching about drum circles and hippie stuff, right? But like when you go to a metal festival and you see a whole bunch of people there for different reasons, all connecting and getting along with the people around them around a drum circle in a way that they probably wouldn't if they were just sitting around at a train station.
Mm-hmm.
There's just something there, man. And it's just beautiful to witness in person. It's the drum circle is almost entirely why I go every year.
Yeah. So do you think people in the Viking, I know obviously it's all speculation,
yep,
would have had that same connection to music? Because I guess for most people, they associate music with that time period as either been maybe ritualistic, mm-hmm, or almost like party-like, very uplifting. Do you think there would have been like those sad songs? Or do you think there would have been songs in general that people would have had that would have replayed, or would it all just be one big constant jam of just going with it? And obviously it's speculation.
No, but this is the type of shit that ethnomusicologists love to do. Well, I'm just going to throw ideas at a wall and see what sticks, right? So if I can just like go off of what happens after the Viking Age, right, is the Nordic countries had a very rich tradition of ballads as soon as the medieval ages started. And the medieval period is where people start being able to write down music, or people get more mobile, so music starts traveling easier with people, because where there's people, there's music. So the Nordics took very quickly to ballads, to medieval ballads. But at the same time, we do actually have one strong trace of music from the Viking Age, right? And that is skaldic poetry. We've yet to have an ethnomusicologist or a musicologist look at skaldic poetry as music. That's sort of like a niche that I'm trying to carve out a little bit here, is that like poetry in a very large part of the world is associated with singing, with music. A lot of this is just also a little fun ethnomusicology fact. We in the West are one of the only cultures that actually have a word for music as an idea. For most of the world, music and dance is the same thing. They're the same word. For a lot of people, music and song is the same word. Music and lyric, same word, and so on and so forth. We gave a word to the idea of music so we can talk about it too much, and thus my profession was born. But so if we take that idea of that poetry and music, or lyric and music, are essentially the same thing. If you look at the structure of some skaldic poetry, they have refrains. Why would a poem have a refrain if one person is just going to recite it? Yeah? Can you
What's a
go?
ref
Yeah?
what's a refrain?
A refrain is a chorus. Sorry. Yeah. So like
Okay.
the chorus. So you have a part in skaldic poems that, you essentially have the verse chorus. You have the
Okay.
verse that one person sings, and you have the chorus that people join in on. And this is from a time where even in there is no word in Old Nordic for music. We have words for dance. We have words for sing. We have words for play, right? We don't have a word for music. And so when there is no word for music, we have to look at where music is implicit rather than explicit.
Okay.
So clearly, singing indicates music. It's not explicit, it's just a part of the word. So if we see that they have words that have to do with making music, but they don't have a word for music, we have to look at where music would have been without labeling it as such. And poetry is kind of the closest that we can get. And so with skaldic poetry, it's not too much of a stretch to think that a lot of these poems might have been sung or performed along with some sort of music.
I guess I would probably just have assumed they would, because it adds to the theater, the performance, to have, even if it's just something as simple as a drum beat, or like a basic rhythm. Is that
Yeah, but like folk
the right
songs, dude, like folk tunes, they go back, right? You don't start writing them down until people have pen and paper, but other than that, like people have always sung or always
word?
sang, whichever form I'm supposed to use there. And what I'm trying to say is that people sing, right? Especially if they're working all day, they make work songs all over the world. Work songs are just a part of life. And so where people are working, people are probably making music too. And people were definitely working in Scandinavia in the during the Viking Age.
Yeah, you do. It's a fascinating phenomenon.
Phenomenon.
Phenomenon. Oh, what was that advert?
And not
Is it?
an anonymity phenomenon.
Well, no chance. But it is, yeah, it is fascinating, because when I used to be, when I was a plumber and I was doing like a board task, like a just a menial task that was just very repetitive, like I would catch myself just singing or like tapping, just making a beat, and I'm not musically minded in any fashion. Like, I'm just not. But it just comes. I just can't help myself but just trying to make a beat. So it makes complete sense that people would have been, whether you were a blacksmith or whatever, if you're making noise, you can just kind of pick tunes from it and pick notes from it and pick bits.
Yeah, man. I mean, so like again, just to, I guess the more concise answer I can give you is that just where there's people, there's music, right? But for throughout the history of the study of music, throughout the history of musicology, people have been reluctant to accept anything that's not written down as actual music. And that's sort of why it's been neglected historically in study. And so that's why, again, for all the bitching and moaning I'll do about, oh, I wish that the world was different now, modernity kind of sucks. At the same time, like, it's a pretty good time to be into this kind of study of music, because now I have something to do.
So what about the performers themselves? Because I guess the culturally today, the the reason for a lot of people to make music is money, I guess. Oh, that's like, well, saying that, I don't know, because that could just be my very ignorant perspective from where I'm sitting, of like, you see these megastars who, but they, again, they probably all got into it on a very base level where they were making absolutely nothing for the longest period of time, got a break. But you do also get like these manufactured bands and artists who are just fed through the system just as a, as like a money, like a cash cow, aren't they? Mm-hmm. So I assume that's a very kind of recent thing.
Oh yeah. I mean, like, that's, yeah, how far back can you argue that that goes? I don't know, but I would say at least since the record industry, where again, you could start selling and marketing things. But then again, there was also like that during the time of like, you would go down to the store and, you know, pay a penny for some sheet music, right? You have people just churning out these like really easy things to write and play. But yeah, during the Viking Age, that wouldn't have been that wouldn't have really been the case. But like, what I can say is that the safest assumption that one can make about who was playing music in the Viking Age, at least in a concrete sort of way, if we go back to the basic premise of spirituality and music being really closely intertwined, you can say that spiritual leaders would have probably been the primary, like, I won't call it serious music, but the primary, like, significant music makers. And at the same time, we also do have the Sami, right? From the same time, from that were way up in the north. They were interacting with the Norse all the time. Mm-hmm. And they definitely had yoik. They definitely had chants. They had their frame drums that were very important to them. And so in that level, you definitely also have, you know, I don't know how much you've talked about Sather on this podcast before. I'm sure you've mentioned at least once.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah. So that type of magic that has something to do with the drum, and then also has something to do with the Sami, right? Like, there's definitely that more concrete relationship between music, transcendence, and spirituality that would have been present in the Viking Age.
Mm-hmm. But I guess that could be compared to the way that people feel, not even just about like modern, it's not Viking music, but that style of music, but about any type of music that people connect to. It can have that spiritual, ritualistic feel to, regardless, it could be any type of music. If it has a connection to a certain person and it reaches them in a certain way, I guess it still could have that comparison of as it had been back then, when, you know, maybe it was thought it was doing some sort of magical good, but it's still a ritualistic purpose.
Yeah, I mean, like, something that really cannot be overlooked is just, let's just imagine that you're a country bumpkin in the middle of nowhere, Norway, in the years, I don't know, 790, right? Suddenly, a monk comes to town, wants to spread the good word, and he starts singing what we would now call Gregorian chant, right? That very real experience of whatever music he was used to hearing. And then all of a sudden, this very well-practiced, well-rehearsed, divine type of music, that alone, I would not be surprised. I have nothing to base this off of, but I would not be surprised if just the experience alone of going into a chapel and hearing sacred music in the context of like an early medieval church was enough to make people go, holy shit, this is incredible. I want this religion just for the music, right? It definitely has that aspect to it. So again, remembering that music is something that is, especially during the Viking Age, not streamed, not played on a record, right? It's something that people hear in person. Yeah.
Yeah.
That definitely increases the effect that it can have on someone.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely. Because anybody that's been to a live concert, there is just a huge difference than listening to it on a streaming service with your headphones in. And I guess as well, even in the Viking Age, the players or the performers would have been rock stars. Like, they would have been. Like, I think, because usually anybody that's performing anything and people are listening to it, they're going to have the admiration of the crowd. And maybe it's not like a rock star in the way we see them today, but I still feel like even back then, some people would have got into it for the fame and the notoriety and the way to have a better life.
I'm just not sure. I don't think that sort of social structure would have existed in the Viking Age, where like the musician is sort of the rock star. Yeah. If
But what
anything,
if, what
music.
about, sorry, I
Yeah.
was just, what about if you did have like the skaldic poetry?
That's where things get interesting
That's kind of,
because.
I was, that's what I was more thinking, like that kind
Okay,
of
no. Cool.
aspect of that.
But still, a skald in Iceland, it's different. In Iceland, very much skalds were, at least as far as I understand, Matthias probably has a well actually somewhere if he listens to this. Skalds, as far as I know, or as far as I understand, they were held in high regard because poetry and literature in Iceland was very highly valued. For someone to be a warrior and a poet was something very highly respected. On mainland Europe, though, if you had the role of a minstrel or a bard or a musician or an entertainer, you were probably not that highly regarded. Iceland is an anomaly, and I don't know enough of the background of that to get into the whys, but I do know that on mainland in mainland Europe, those in the entertainer category were usually just seen as nothing more than like jesters, where you're here for entertainment and that's about it.
Oh,
But
okay.
in communal life, non-aristocratic life, everyone would have played music or at least sung something. It wasn't something as special as, oh, I took guitar lessons. It was just like music is
Okay.
a part of existing. And so most people would have at least some attunement to it just by going through their day to day.
Okay, so when do you think that switch happened? Where it, is that possible to find where it really does become this where people want to be a, the profession is a musician and it's going to better your life.
That comes way later. Even into like the periods I'm going to use are like, Baroque, the Baroque period. Let's just make it easy. So even in Bach's time, okay, in the Baroque period, think of the time of J.S. Bach, the guy who wrote the Pretty Cello Suites. As highly regarded as he is today in the history of Western art, during his lifetime, he was seen as nothing more than a service worker. It was his job. He had a job to do. He had to show up. You don't really get much praise. You are literally just the guy making music, and that's all there is to it. It's not really until the time of Mozart and then afterwards Beethoven. So we're really past Vikings at this point, where that becomes like sort of a way that you look at music. Before that, it was just another job to do. It was just another trade skill to have. You would get some fame with it. England is also a pretty strong exception to this because you had like opera writers in the 1500s named like Purcell and stuff like that, and they were highly regarded. But largely, music being a musician was not really so much of a thing to like expect praise for until much later because music, at least, unless it was spiritual, of course. So if we're talking about just like regular ass music making, that was just something people did.
Fair enough. Let's, because we're, I need to go finish moving house.
No, I know, man.
so let's, yeah, let's wrap this up now. Obviously you're welcome back anytime in the future. This has been a lot of,
I think I actually am coming back in about a month to talk about a musical
oh, awesome.
with Matthias
Oh.
and the playwright Andy. We're working on a musical on the founding of Iceland.
Oh,
So
wow.
I think we're going to be back sometime in early October for
Okay, yeah, I'm definitely looking
that.
forward to that. But obviously, if you want to hear more from Jameson, we're going to jump over and do a quick Q&A, which you get as part of Patreon. So again, it's patreon.com/ Nordic Mythology Podcast. You get that for, like I said, £3 a month, and you get a bonus episode every week where we do a Q&A with the guest after. It's like a, it's a standalone episode. You can listen to it after the fact. You can submit your questions before or submit them live. And there's a bunch of extra knowledge and extra good content that comes after the fact. So yeah, go definitely go and check that out if you can. Jameson, where can people follow you, listen to you, listen to your music?
Yeah, so you can find me. Just there are not many Jameson Fosters, so if you just look me up, you'll find me. You can just also find me by looking up the Nordic Sound Channel on Instagram, just at Nordic Sound Channel. Also on YouTube, the music, as I said, if you look up Scuzzlebutt Banjo, just so you Google that, I will definitely pop up. Or just go to Instagram and do at Banjo Druid. Dan, thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about that. I actually don't talk about that.
You should.
So often I
You
try no
should.
I try not to mix up the music I do with the Nordic Sound Channel because I feel like it would like I don't know compromise integrity if I'm using it as a platform to promote myself. But yes, thank you for asking me about that. But otherwise,
Do
that's those are all the places you can find me
it.
or come
Do
to
both.
Colorado.
That's it. Yeah, if you enjoy the show, please leave us a 5-star rating and a positive review. And yeah, follow us on all the social media channels at Nordic Mythology Podcast. But yeah, let's jump over and answer some questions. Thank you, Jameson.
Yeah, of course, man. Thanks for having me.
Perfect.